son, you got a panty on your head.
Just drive fast, eh?
Turn to the right!
The first time I met Ed was in the county lockup in Tempe, Arizona.
You're a flower, you are.
A day I'll never forget.
I do.
You bet I do.
Okay, then.
My lawless years were behind me. Our child-rearing years lay ahead. But biology conspired to keep us childless.
You go right back up there and get me a toddler. I need a baby hide. I got more than I can handle.
But at the time, Ed's little plan seemed like the solution to all our problems. And the answer to all our prayers.
He's beautiful.
What are you kidding? We got us a family here.
I want Nathan Jr. back.
What's his name?
Ed Jr.
Hi, Junior.
So far, we've just been using Junior.
We call him Junior.
He's out there somewhere.
Hold on, Nathan. We're gonna go pick up Daddy.
I'll be taking these Huggies and whatever cash you got.
You busted out of jail.
We released Trishaz on our own recognizance.
What Evel here is trying to say is that we felt the institution no longer had anything to offer us.
We got a child now. Everything's changed.
Yeah! Where's Junior?
Who the hell are you?
I'm a man.
We're absolutely going to get him back. This ain't no question about that.
Give me that baby, you warthog from hell!
Hey, you want to know another thing? I'm going to be a better person from here on out. Let's go get Nathan Jr.
Raising Arizona, a comedy beyond belief.
Well, it ain't Ozzie and Harriet.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCriscio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. I'm excited to get into a good Nicolas Cage movie, so...
Boom.
Well, we've done a few, actually.
Yeah, take
Let me take that back.
Take that, The Boy in Blue.
Yeah. Oh,
Mic
man.
Drop.
Yeah, boom.
Yeah, yeah. I think this will be an interesting podcast, in part because we're talking about one of my favorite movies, and also because I'm operating on, like, 3 hours of sleep right now.
Yeah, so it's probably going to be silly.
Yeah, it's if I start, like, spacing out and... If I fall asleep at some point in the podcast, you have permission to shout and wake me.
All right. Maybe I'll just make this like a 5-hour podcast with 4 hours of dead air in the middle.
That's entirely up to you. I mean,
I'm
the editor here, so I...
you know. Our listeners demand the truth, Mike.
We want something.
All four of them.
We need something real, man. We don't want one of these fly-by-night edited podcasts.
We need podcast verite, Mike.
Well, today on Podcast Verite, Mike and I are going to be discussing 1987's Raising Arizona, featuring Cage as the film's protagonist, H.I. McDonough, and directed again by two of my favorite directors of all time, Joel and Ethan Coen. An IMDb plot synopsis reads, "When a childless couple of an ex-con and an ex-cop decide to help themselves to one another family's quintuplets, their lives get more complicated than they anticipated." True.
The continuing saga of bare bones IMDb synopsis.
Yeah, the most vague possible thing you could possibly come up with.
Yeah.
Their lives get more complicated.
True.
All you need to know, really.
That's all.
This was the second film directed by the Coen brothers after 1984's Blood Simple. The goal here was to make something as different as Blood Simple as possible. This movie is upbeat. It's more outwardly funny. The characters are actually written to be sympathetic, which is, for a Coen brothers movie, is actually kind of rare. But the Coens-esque touches are there in both movies. The way the camera moves, the way the characters speak to each other, they're two completely different movies that have a very similar sensibility, which I think makes them a really cool pair of movies. They're also a very much looser vibe than the Coen brothers movies would have in the future, I think. It's as if their style isn't like quite refined yet.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? It feels like a little more ramshackle, a little more like... They're still kind of working out the kinks a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense, actually, because as I was watching it, I was kind of, like, not grabbed by it the same way I am by other Coen Brothers movies, and then in looking at their filmography, just before we started, Fargo was the earliest movie I had seen by them. So it makes sense that this...
Yeah, I mean, you have
that's like the most stylized Coen Brothers movie. Right.
I mean, you have to fix that immediately. Yeah. All this, that's like you're missing like six great movies.
Yeah. Well, as talked about in our last episode of the Film Book Cast, I have exposed myself as a sham film buff. So
right, yeah, you're more of an enthusiast.
I'm an enthusiast, yeah, exactly.
And I think the relationship between Nicolas Cage and the Coens on this film is interesting as well, because during the 10 weeks of shooting, Cage would offer suggestions for his character and for the scenes he was shooting to the Coens, which they always ignored.
Oh, poor Nick Cage.
Yeah, I mean, this was a learning experience for Cage in some ways. He actually he has a quote on Wikipedia, so you know it's true. Yes. As he puts it, Joel and Ethan have a strong vision, and I've learned how difficult it is to accept another artist's vision. And I was thinking about that because I think up to this point, Cage had been working with directors who mostly let him play around with what he was doing, right? Okay. I mean, like, if you look at the performance we've gotten so far, he's played a fair variety of characters, but a lot of them kind of have similar mannerisms and similar tics, and that's part of that is Cage being Cage, I think. Like, he's... You know, and most of his performances, I think, up to this point, you know that's Nicolas Cage you're watching, right? And I think I was talking to you about this before... his performance in this movie doesn't necessarily feel like Cage. It feels like he's really embodied the character of H.I. McDonough.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I got that feeling too. And I wondered if that's a symptom of the fact that H.I. is like kind of crazy. And I wonder if that just
right. I think he fits the role very well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, up to this point, the only real auteur director he had worked for was the guy he was related to.
Right.
Francis Ford Coppola on three of his films. So I imagine Coppola was pretty lenient about what Cage could or could not do. Yeah. And so the Coens were relatively strict in how they wanted this to be portrayed. And H.I. McDonough has since gone on to be one of his most acclaimed and iconic performances, at least in my eyes. And those are really the only eyes that count, because this is our podcast.
Correct.
So it was a valuable lesson, I think. I think it helps him... in the future when he worked for auteur directors, like, for example, he worked with David Lynch on Wild at Heart, or Spike Jonze for Adaptation, or Martin Scorsese for Bringing Out the Dead. I think those movies are from people who will have a strong vision and, you know, get Cage to be like one specific character. And those those generally bring out his best performances as well.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that. Him... being reined in some way, if that's what was going on. It seems that leads to his best performances.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, at the same time, I love watching Reined Out Cage, because that also has some of his best performances.
Right, that's true.
Raising Arizona made about $29 million on a budget of $6 million, making it a solid hit, despite mixed reviews at the time. It's grown a lot in popularity since then. It even placed number 31 on the American Film Institute's list of the 100 greatest comedies of all time.
Wow.
The film stars Nicolas Cage as H.I. McDonough, also known as High throughout the film. Holly Hunter as Ed McDonough in a character that was written specifically for her. Trey Wilson as Nathan Arizona Sr., John Goodman, William Forsythe, Sam McMurray, Francis McDormand, and Randall Tex Cobb. The film was written and directed by Joel and Ethan Coen as their second film, 3 years after Blood Simple and 3 years before Miller's Crossing. So we're both coming at this movie from different angles, Mike, because I have seen Raising Arizona many, many times. I probably the first Coen Brothers movie I ever saw was probably No Country for Old Men, right, when that came out in theaters. And that kind of spurred me to just see as many Coen Brothers movies as I could. And Raising Arizona was the one that was playing on TV a few weeks after that. So Raising Arizona was the second Coen Brothers movie I ever saw. Probably saw it when I was like 13 or 14 and loved it and have watched it many times since. But you had not seen it up at this point.
Yeah, not seen it before.
Yeah, so I guess let's start with you. I mean, everybody knows my opinion of Raising Arizona already. I've seen it many times. What did you think of the movie overall?
Overall, it was good. Like I said, it didn't grab me the same way other Coen Brothers movies have. And I think I didn't think of it that you know, the style hadn't been refined yet like all their later movies that, you know, you could watch a movie and immediately within, you know, a few minutes be like, yeah, this is definitely a Coen Brothers movie. Yeah.
Well, I think you can do that with this movie. Like this feels it feels like a Coen Brothers movie.
It does feel like a Coen Brothers movie. Yeah. But it just feels a little looser, I guess, and whatever.
A little ramshackle.
Yeah. Great word. Good choice.
It's the kind of word the characters in this movie would use.
Yes, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Everyone always talks about, you know, the way Quentin Tarantino writes dialogue, but, I mean, everyone always talks about the Coen Brothers dialogue also, and that's one of my favorite parts of their movies.
Yes, and the dialogue in this movie is fantastic.
It's just so silly and ridiculous. Yeah. No one would talk that way, but it's the best way.
Yeah, I think I was reading online that the Coens, the way they wrote the dialogue in this movie is to create their character's dialect, Joel and Ethan Coen created a hybrid of local dialect and the assumed reading material of the characters, namely magazines and the Bible.
Perfect.
Part of what this movie does, I think, that's really interesting is that it takes it does something that the Coens have done a couple times throughout their career, which is take, like, one specific part of America and exaggerate all of their mannerisms.
Yes, yes.
Which we mentioned Fargo earlier, but that's like the entire joke in Fargo. A lot of the time, you know?
Right, is that this? Yeah, absolutely.
So I think they do that here to really good effect as well. They take the southwestern portion of the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the way, like, right at the beginning, just the montage of Nicolas Cage being arrested over and over again.
Yes.
It's ridiculous and awesome. It did kind of lose me a little in the middle, I guess. I don't know. Okay. But that said, I did enjoy the film overall. There were lots of points where I'm sure we're going to talk about the car chase. Just wants the huggies, man. just stuff like that. It is overtly funny. Like, not a lot of Coen Brothers have very, like, subtle, awkward humor, and this is just like straight up comedy stuff going on.
This is like screwball type stuff. And it works really well. I think there's a lot of like deeper symbolism throughout the film that isn't necessarily like on a comedy level, but like specifically with Leonard Smalls, the lone biker of the apocalypse. Which is actually, that's how he's credited in the movie. Leonard Smalls / Lone Biker of the Apocalypse. Cage refers to him as the Lone Biker of the Apocalypse in his first monologue about him.
When he's having his dream.
Yeah, and Cage has these visions throughout the movie of this guy on a motorcycle, and at the end of the movie, they face off. They meet face to face, and at the end of the movie, you see that the biker has the same tattoo, the same Woody Woodpecker tattoo that Nicolas Cage does. And it's like, whoa. And Nicolas Cage like steps back. And there's like this moment of like realization, and I mean, what do you think that meant? Like,
I don't know. At that point, I didn't even know what was going on. I was like, "Is this Cage? Is this a part of Cage?" Like,
well, my understanding of that scene, I think I've seen some fan theories that like that scene means that like he is Nicolas Cage's father. I don't think that works. I think I think that's a very literal interpretation of what that would be. I think it's much more meant to be on a symbolic level.
Yeah, it's subconscious, like, what's going on?
Well, I got the sense that Leonard, to me, is what High could have been had he not met Ed and fell in love with her. Like, that's the life that he could have led.
Yeah, just Mad Maxing across the country.
Yeah, well, being an outlaw, basically.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they talk about that. That's a thing that comes up a lot in the film is, you know, as soon as they look at, when they take Nathan Jr., he's going to be an outlaw. Like, they talk about that. Yeah, looking in his eyes. Yeah,
a couple times. Cage mentions it, and then as soon as, like, John Goodman shows up, John Goodman mentions it.
Says it too, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about John Goodman and William Forsythe, because they're, like, my favorite part of this movie. One of the most iconic... Probably the most iconic image from this movie is John Goodman coming out of the ground and pulling William Forsythe out with him. Like,
upside down.
In the rain and the mud, upside down.
Yeah.
Just screaming the entire time.
Yeah, there's a lot of moments like that happens, like that when he's screaming. And then when they leave Junior on the roof of the car and they realize, and they just yell. Like,
the entire time.
The whole time, as they drive
the entire car ride, they're screaming. And it's the best. I think John Goodman screaming is my favorite part of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's so great, John Goodman. Just like when they come out and they're in the truck side, the gas station, putting the pomade on their hair, and it's just like it's hilarious. He's not even doing anything besides putting pomade in his hair, and he's so funny.
Yeah, he's great. This was his first Coen Brothers movie. He's been in like 5 of them. After this, he was in Barton Fink, and he was in Big Lebowski, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Inside Llewyn Davis. And this was the first one. This is where it all started for John Goodman.
Makes sense. It was their second movie.
Well, yeah, obviously.
But that's what another thing too about. I mean, this is just going to be a wank fest over the Coen Brothers, I guess. But
why change things?
Good point. I mean, it's the same thing like with Tarantino too. That just has the same cast over and over again, and that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah, they do reuse a lot of the same actors. Like John Goodman's in a bunch of their movies.
Frances McDormand.
She's Joel Coen's wife.
There you go. That makes a lot more sense.
Did you not know that?
No.
Yeah, no, she's Joel Coen's wife. I think they've been like dating since they made Blood Simple. I'm pretty sure she's in Blood Simple. She's definitely in this movie. And it's a small part in this movie, but she's great in it. Her and her husband, played by Sam McMurray.
Yeah, that was a very weird scene.
Yeah, I love how their kids are like the absolute worst. Total nightmares.
Terrible.
I love the way Frances McDormand comes in and just like freaks out about the baby and is like, it's an angel. An angel straight from heaven. And then immediately she goes, so you're going to send him to Arizona State.
Right. Yeah, like, I mean, like you said too, it's just the stereotypical or hyperbolic regional thing.
Yes.
That's what a person from Arizona is like.
Yeah, and her whole conversation with Holly Hunter about like the things I have to do for the baby. I've quoted that many times. Where if I need somebody to like do something, I was like, gotta get that hat. Gotta get that hat.
You set up a bank account yet? Gotta do that.
Gotta get on that, huh? Have we done that, honey?
Yeah. It's great. Really weird. And then they're swingers, apparently.
Yeah. I think Glenn, played by Sam Murray, he has that Pollock joke that makes me crack up every time, purely on his delivery, because it's like, how many Pollocks would take a screw to a light bulb? And he's like, I don't know, Glenn. One. Yeah. No, it takes 3! And he just starts laughing.
He just loses his mind. Oh, yeah. It's great.
He's like, no, wait, I told that wrong. Yeah. It's like, because they're so darn stupid.
Right.
Come on, don't you get it?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. And that's one of my like my favorite things about Coen Brothers movies, is just the like awkward situations that happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then my other favorite part that we talked about a lot was, you know, the use of all of the Sam Raimi cam.
Yes. For those unfamiliar, I don't think you knew this until I told you, but Sam Raimi and Coen Brothers used to be like very like they used to work together a lot.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Joel Coen was actually an editor on The Evil Dead, the original Evil Dead, and they worked together on a lot of their movies. They actually wrote Sam Raimi's second movie called Crime Wave, which starred Bruce Campbell, and Sam Raimi worked on a couple of their movies too. He has cameos in a couple of their films, and as an homage to him and his Evil Dead movies, they used a lot of Raimi cam in this movie, which, for those unfamiliar with Raimi cam...
Yes, tell us all the things.
Is that shot from Evil Dead and from several Sam Raimi's movies where the camera just keeps moving forward like through a bunch of different things. And so in the Evil Dead, it's going through the woods, getting into the cabin. Here, it's used most notably, I think, during the scene where the mom finds Nathan Jr. missing.
Right.
Or Nathan Jr., we think. We're not sure if it's Nathan Jr.
We think it's Nathan Jr.
Yeah, that's a really funny joke. I like that a lot.
Which was a great recurring joke as well.
Yeah. And like the camera just zooms through the desert and up the ladder and into the mom's screaming mouth, while Cage is having like a vision of like that happening, and it's like cutting back and forth between Cage, and I think it works really well. It's really good. And that kind of kinetic camera work, I think, is...
That scene is really creepy, and, you know, it's the same effect at, I think, the very last shot of the original Evil Dead as the camera zooms through the cabin and, like, goes through the door and then goes into Ash's screaming mouth.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. I like those kinds of homages, too, and especially to Sam Raimi.
Right, yeah.
Who doesn't like Sam Raimi things?
Yeah, and I mean, this movie has a lot of kinetic camera work in addition to that. Like, there's a, you know, really unique... Like, this is, at its basic thing, there's, you know, one of those high-concept comedies that got made a lot in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? Like, it feels like there are several 80s comedies this could fit alongside of. But I feel like this has, like... a much greater sense of visual style. There's a lot of unique camera angles here. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of shots from the baby's point of view.
Right.
When Cage is kidnapping them. So you'll have, like, the baby just kind of looking over the crib and seeing Cage crawling under the crib.
Right. That scene was weird as hell. He's kidnapping them and they're, like, crawling all over. And then he just, like, aborts mission.
Yeah, I guess there's some great physical comedy from Cage there. Yeah. And we're going to talk more about Cage's performance in a little bit. I did want to talk about Holly Hunter, who I love... in this movie and in general, like,
yeah,
I really think she should be in more things. And I
was like, gonna say, I don't think I know her in many things.
Really? I mean, she's
on a TV show right now, right? Or was
she did have a small role in Oh Brother Where Art Thou? She was on a TV show. I think she was on
it's like some cop drama. I don't know if it's still around or not.
Yeah, I think. Hold on one second. I'm gonna look this up. I mean, she is gonna be in Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. I don't know if you knew that. She was on a TV show from 2007 to 2010 called Saving Grace. I think that's what you're thinking of.
I think so.
But yeah, I mean, she's going to be in Batman vs. Superman. She's in the new Terrence Malick movie, actually, too.
Wow.
But she hasn't done a ton of movies over the past, like, several years. The Incredibles is probably the most notable one, as Helen Parr / Elastigirl.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, she used to be in a bunch of stuff. She was in... Raising Arizona, obviously. She was in Broadcast News in the same year. The Piano, The Firm, like, a lot of stuff here.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like we don't get to see her as often anymore, but I really like her, and I think she's great in this movie. She really captures Ed really well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. She plays that, like, thinks she has a handle on everything, but doesn't really kind of character.
Yeah, like, and, like, her southern act, like, her voice is just so perfect for that character, yeah. I think, too. Like, she has Holly Hunter's a very distinctive voice, and I think it works really well for that character. What did you think of the opening, which is an 11-minute voiceover narration from Nicolas Cage?
I must have liked it because I didn't realize it was 11 minutes.
Right? Like, it just takes you through the whole thing, and then suddenly it's Raising Arizona. Like, the title comes up.
I kind of like that just get it all out of the way before we start kind of thing.
Yeah, and I love the design of that, too. The sound design particularly, I actually had never really noticed it until now because I was taking notes. But the way the sound design works, you know, there's this bluegrassy yodeling soundtrack throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's there throughout most of the voiceover, but there's the scene where Ed and Cage find out that Ed is barren.
Right.
And in that scene, the music cuts out completely, and you just hear wind.
Yes, I did notice that. You're right.
And I think that's pretty, like, brilliant for that scene. Yeah. Like, when she finds out she's barren.
Barren, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I picked up on that, but didn't put it together in any kind of way. So, good job, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I had never really, like, noticed it until now. Like, it's just one of those things, like, I was just, like, looking for, and like, whoa, right. Cool. And I think that whole 11-minute voiceover, it takes you through basically their entire relationship up to this point. And right. I think it does a really good job of getting you invested in those characters. You know, and it's crazy. Like, most movies in 11 minutes can't do that. Like,
right. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, and it sets it up that, you know, it tells you everything that you need to know. And you, like you said, you do feel for them in some way, despite also, them being... terrible people in the way. You know? I mean, they're not terrible people, but, like, he keeps robbing stores and stuff.
Well, I think the thing is, they're, like, decent people at their core, who are just, like, they think they're doing the right thing. Like, they think they're doing something right.
Right. That makes sense, yeah.
You know, and, like, ultimately, they think, because they're, like, you know, their whole rationale for taking Nathan Jr. Is that, A, Ed can't have kids and wants one, but also... the Arizonas have more than they can handle.
Right, right. Which is a refrain throughout the film also.
Yeah, they got more than they can handle.
Yeah, they got more than they can handle.
But also that 11-minute voiceover, like you said, it does introduce you everything you need to know, in addition to getting you through Cage and Hunter's relationship and mm-hmm. getting you up to the conflict of how they can have kids and how the Arizonas have one. It even introduces you to John Goodman and William Forsythe, who are going to come up later in the movie.
Right.
You know, it even has that. It also has one of my favorite lines where, you know, they're in, like, the prison meeting. And
right, talking, support group or whatever.
Support group, and they're like, oh, you know, a lot of men your age want to be raising families. They want to be feeling fulfilled. And William Forsythe is like, work's what makes us happy.
Right. Yeah, he was great. He was amazing.
Yeah, he's a good, like, dunce to John Goodman's, like, less of a dunce, but still right. kind of a dunce. Like,
thinks he knows character. What he's doing.
Yeah, yeah, they're a good duo.
Which is another trope that runs through a lot of Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah, people who think they know what they're doing but don't.
Yeah, who think they've got it all figured out.
Yep. All right, you want to talk about Cage now? Since we've
let's get some Cage stuff.
Let's talk about Cage. So as we were saying, I mean, Cage like had his performance here. I think is his best one yet because he really embodies the character of High in a way that like. You don't realize you're watching Cage.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I would agree with that. Yeah, this is the, like, you know, this is the least... simultaneously, the least and most Cage role.
Yeah.
Because it's very, like, frenetic and crazy and uncontrolled, but, like, so is the character.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of ways. And he shows a lot of real emotion during a lot of scenes, and shows a really great gift for physical comedy and verbal comedy. Like, he does the dialogue really well. He he anchors the movie with his voiceovers, you know, and he has to say, like, really unique and funny lines, like, Edwina's insides were a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase.
Right. Yeah. Yep. There's a lot of stuff like that. I also, just the state of his hair throughout almost the whole movie.
Oh, yeah, it's wild.
It's out of control. But that's just how High is. I don't know, it's great. Exactly.
Yeah, but I was talking about like his physical comedy, like when he was with, like trying to take the babies. You know, he's just like stumbling around that room, like trying to grab kids left and right. And like
right.
It's really, I think it's really funny and shows like a side of Cage that we don't get to see that often as like a physical comedy guy.
Yeah, I think this is the most comedic role we've seen him in so far.
Pretty much, except for maybe Best of Times.
I forgot about Best of Times. How could I do that though?
Yeah, I mean, come on, it was the Best of Times.
It was the Best of Times,
and we had the Best of Times reviewing it.
Yeah, and now we've referenced it and can move on. Got to get it in at least once per episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think, this is his most comedic performance yet, because mostly he's been doing, like, supporting roles in dramas up to this point.
Right.
And, you know, you get a little bit of letting his crazy flag fly every once in a while in those movies. I think, what was it, Birdie, you got a little bit, right?
Yep.
I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
How you flew.
How you flew. I do remember that. You get more of his crazy side in Piggy Sue Got Married, I think, than you do in... a lot of his other, a lot of the ones we had written before it, but this really like takes it to another level. But it's not like crazy, crazy Cage. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's like acting crazy.
It's a guy who's like a little unhinged,
right? And especially, I think, couple that Cage is, you know, I mean, you can't deny the fact that he is a good actor,
right?
At this point in his career, that we're up to
slam
and. Yeah, boom, got him. Take that, Cage.
Oh, man. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about his career post-2010, because
I
still think he's a great actor.
Is this all some like, Shia LaBeouf-style performance art piece?
Yes, Cage is gonna watch all of his movies backwards in a theater for, like, 5 days straight.
I can't wait.
It would take longer, actually, probably.
It'll take a long time.
Yeah, like, Shia LaBeouf do it in 3 days. He would take at least a week, I think.
At least. But, like, couple, you know, Cage's acting ability with the strong vision of the Coen brothers, like we, you know, talked about before, that their directors or what that have, that, you know, wouldn't let him make suggestions, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. Yes. And, and I imagine in his other movies he could make, like, his own, kind of bring his own thing to it, whereas this one, you know, he had to follow a direction. And it worked out really well. I can imagine. I can definitely see that being annoying on his part. To have that be in a position where you can like control your own performance and like do what you want to do, and then to be told you can't do that.
Right.
That could be jarring.
Right.
But it worked out really well for this movie. And I think for his next one, Moonstruck, I have not seen Moonstruck, but I feel like that's a very popular movie.
It is. I've never seen it either, but I know people like it.
And I know he's supposedly gives a very good performance in that movie as well, so I don't know what it's like there. But I know he's going to be in Wild at Heart. I've mentioned that Wild at Heart adaptation, Bringing Out the Dead, and a bunch of other cool like genre movies as well. And I feel like right. In most of his movies, he will probably be able to just let his freak flag fly. But yeah. But there's a few, like this one, where he's, you know, kind of constrained to what the director wants.
And, yeah.
You know, I think ultimately that works out very well for him, even if it's a little annoying on his part.
Yeah. For him. I mean, at least he took away the right message, it seemed, from that quote.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And you want to talk about the huggy scene as well, right?
Right. Yeah, the car chase.
Yes.
I feel like that's the iconic
That is the iconic scene. I think the image of John Goodman coming out of the ground has been repeated so many times that that's kind of the iconic shot.
Right.
But the iconic, like, sequence from this movie is the huggy chase scene.
Yeah.
Because, like, you had not seen the movie, but you knew about the huggy chase scene, I'm guessing.
I knew that was a thing, yeah.
Yeah.
That, I mean, the yeah, that and the image, I think it's, like, the first time we see Hi, when he's getting his mugshot in the red Hawaiian shirt.
Yes, yeah.
Is the other iconic image.
Right, yeah, that's the, I think that's the DVD cover. Like, that's the
I think that might even be the case, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go, that makes sense. But yeah, just, that was just pure, like, physical screwball shenanigans.
Yes,
this car.
Yeah, I love it.
This huggy chase.
It escalates so quickly, and it just, like, goes into so many different directions. I mean, you know, you get the car going. Right. Mm-hmm. You have Cage getting a guy in a truck, and then there's, like, dogs chasing them, and then they go yep. through a supermarket, and also the clerk from the previous store is shooting at them, and, yep. like...
The cops are shooting at them as they drive.
They go through somebody's house.
Yeah.
and all the dogs run through the house, and it's great. It's...
Yep.
It's, like, it escalates so quickly, and, like, it ends on such a perfect note where Cage is just, like, grabbing the huggies out of the street.
Right. Yep. And he just... Holly Hunter following him, just going, son of a bitch. That's
son
all
of
she
bitch.
Says.
Yeah,
that's
she's all like she yelling says. At him, like, you son of a bitch!
Yeah, yeah, it's great. And it's, I don't know. I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I did also want to mention the ending of this movie, because I think it ends on one of my favorite ending lines of any movie that I've seen. Okay. I'll repeat it.
Thanks, man.
Let me see. It's when Cage's having his vision. About, mm-hmm. like, you know, about, like, the future and about how, like, you know, Nathan Jr. might grow up to be a football star or whatever. And he right. has a vision about him and Ed as this old couple. Right. And he has this, like, paragraph, and I'm going to read it here. But still I hadn't dreamt nothing about me and Ed until the end. And this was cloudier because it was years, years away. But I saw an old couple being visited by their children and all their grandchildren, too. The old couple weren't screwed up, and neither were their kids or their grandkids. And I don't know, you tell me. This whole dream, was it wishful thinking? Was that just fleeing reality like I know I'm liable to do? But me and Ed, we can be good too, and it seemed real. It seemed like us, and it seemed like, well, our home. If not Arizona, then a land not too far away, where all parents are strong and wise and capable, and all children are happy and beloved. I don't know. Maybe it was Utah. Cuts to credits.
Like, cuts to credits, yeah.
So, I love that line. I think it's a... Like
yeah,
really
that's
good,
pretty perfect.
Yeah, it's a great ending note for the movie.
Yeah, that's one of the things, too, I love about the Coen Brothers films. They take such small stories and blow them to such huge proportions, but then
yep.
still maintain the, like, locality, like, how
yeah,
small it
the
is.
The smallness of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, this is all...
Like, we get this huge... car chase through people's houses. There's this big gun battle with the rider of the apocalypse and all this stuff. But maybe Utah's the promised land. Like, it's so, I don't know. It's so great.
Yes. All right. Is there anything else you want to talk about Raising Arizona before we wrap it up, Mike?
No. I think we've done all we can.
Cool. All right. Well, that is Raising Arizona. Again, a movie that I really love, and Mike seems to enjoy it as well.
Yeah.
If not on the level that I do. But
not quite your style level.
That's okay. That's okay. You know, we're all allowed
we can have different opinions.
We're all allowed to have different opinions, and we're all allowed to be wrong. So,
you know, I knew you'd always look out for me, Mike.
All right. Well, where can we find you online this week, Mike?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
And you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all of my podcasts for Arrow and for Gotham and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. We also do a film bookcast on filmbook.com. And Mike, where else? Can we find you on like Twitch or something too? Isn't that a thing you do?
Oh, sometimes, yes. my group that I play D&D with, we sometimes stream our D&D games. We don't have a very regular schedule, but if you go to twitch.tv/geonerd79, you can find the previous games are up on the video on demand there.
Very cool. All right. Thank you guys for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. This is Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, top discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We've used so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks, where we'll be discussing Nicolas Cage opposite an Oscar-winning performance from Cher in Moonstruck.
What a weird sentence.
I don't know, man. Do you believe in life after love?
You're the worst.
And you can check out this week's film bookcast, where I guess Mike and I will be reviewing the final film in the Hunger Games series. Mockingjay Part 2. Are you excited about that, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, that's a franchise that exists, so why not?
Yeah, I feel like every time one comes out, I'm like, all right, yeah, I'll go see a Hunger Games movie. And I usually like it more than I like the last movie.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, so, it's been getting better.
So
it's just been a year, and I kind of forgot.
Yeah, exactly. It's, it's Hunger Games. I'll check it out. I'll probably enjoy it, and then I'll forget about it like a few months later.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. And then after that, I'm very excited about Creed, which is probably the next movie we're going to review.
Yeah,
I don't know if you heard the early reviews of that movie have been pretty stellar. I mean, I guess you can't hear the actual reviews of that movie because it's still embargoed. But right. Mike Ryan started a movement to get people to just start praising the band Creed.
Right.
In lieu of the film. Which is funny because the band Creed sucks.
Thanks for explaining the joke, Mike.
You're welcome. That's basically this entire podcast. So
yeah, that's a good point.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.